November 14, 2017, Masoret. We're starting off by discussing a story that's brought down either in a midrash, I'm not sure where, in the Gemara, about a, you know, this was a rav, a big rav, and his wife, however, was had, I guess, a negative, a type of a personality, and one of the manifestations was that whatever he would ask for to eat, she would give him the opposite. So let's say, for argument's sake, if he wanted meat, so she would give him cheese or something like that, along those lines. And this disturbed his son. His son was sort of, would serve him, would bring him the food. He would tell his mother what the father wanted, and then every time he'd get the opposite. And this bothered him a lot, that his father was being mistreated. So he devised a method, and that is that whatever the father wanted, he would ask for the exact opposite. And then what he would get back would be what the father really wanted, not what he asked for. So after a while, the father commented that, you know, things have improved, that, you know, your mother is treating me much better now, and so on and so forth. And then the son told him why, what the factor was. So the father then told him not to do it anymore. So we're just raising the question, why? Why would he tell him not to do it? Seems like a pretty good solution. In point of fact, now that we're talking about that, would you, if you were counseling any of your, I don't know, friends, relatives in a marriage, would you ever give this kind of advice? I'm not, you know, just in general terms, doesn't have to be the exact situation. I don't know how many people have this exact problem, that this is the problem in their marriage. But there's many areas that it could apply to. That there's a lot of discord. So that I'll give you a very simple example. Let's say one of the spouses has an issue with lateness. This is a problem that a number of couples have. That one of them, let's say if it's traveling, one of them likes to be there early, especially if there's kids, they like to be there early and with plenty of time, especially today when it's really, you know, with the long lines and the security and so on and so forth. And there are others, I know there are people that like last minute people, not just because they're preoccupied or because they're lazy, it's just they like the last minute. They actually enjoy the drama or the challenge. So they'll calculate the minimal amount of time that it would take. And they have a certain feeling of exhilaration or it's danger. And now, if you don't have that mentality, so it's excruciating, it's really painful. Because, I personally am of the first kind. I like to get early. I have no patience, you know, for the lines and for the last minute and all of that. I don't need that. And I also find that basically if I'm leaving at noon, so that morning I'm really not going to be into anything. I'm kind of, either I'm packing and that and all. When you finally pack, you just wait around. It's not an opportunity to sit down and really get into something. So I might as well go to the airport. This way I go, you know, relaxed. I'm not in any rush. And then I go through the, I don't mind waiting. See, for me, it's really, I get there. And I go through the security. I get to my, gate. And then I just relax, take out a book, read, whatever. So I'm much better off over there. In fact, going home from Chicago on Monday morning, so my son took me on the way to work, which is early. So the flight was 10:30, and he got me to the airport about 7:15, you know, because he had to go to work. But I didn't mind it at all. I didn't mind, so I had like, I don't know, three hour wait or whatever. Just find a comfortable place. You could have coffee, whatever, and you could read. So that's my attitude. But anyways, there are people that are just the opposite. So sometimes, I'm not saying which is, it's not a question of right and wrong. It's a matter of your taste. So now I did have to actually, I've counseled couples that did have that issue. So it's a source of, well, I mean, I don't know how often you're traveling, but whenever you do, it's a source of stress. But it doesn't only have to express itself in traveling. You'll see in like if you're going to a function, you're going to a wedding or a bar mitzvah or whatever, it'll always, you know, one person likes to be there early and doesn't want to put up with the traffic and all that and really feels bad if they're going to get there late. And the other person can't get there late enough or whatever it is. So, okay, would you then... Yes.
It's Yevamos 63a.
Oh, okay, just wanted to thank you very much. The source for the story is Yevamos. I'm going to write that down. That's Samach Gimel Aleph. Anyone that wants to look up the story itself. It's an interesting story. You could bring it up at the dinner table. No, but I'm saying in these types of matters, would it be okay to lie? That is, you know, let's say, you know, your husband, let's say, he's the one that likes to be at the last minute. And he asks you what time is the flight? Okay, so instead of telling him the exact time, you could push it, let's say, you know, 45 minutes or even an hour, whatever. Because he doesn't bother to check. He assumes you're honest. And so on and so forth. In those kind of... What time is the lunch called for the bar mitzvah? So you just tell him a different time. Now, he'll be thinking it's at the last minute. And in point of fact, it'll work out for you as well. The only thing is, in practically speaking, it might not be good because he'll see. In other words, if you told him that the plane is taking off at 3 when it's really 4, so when he gets to the airport, he'll know. So then you're going to have another lie. They change it. I mean, you'll get caught. That's not my point, though. Let's assume, because I haven't thought through all the possibilities. There are plenty of possibilities where these types of lies would solve a problem. In other words, both sides, just like this lie was perfect. This lie was a perfect. Actually, it was kind of safe because she would have no way of knowing. How would she know that he really... had asked for something else. That is, he really wanted meat, and the son had mentioned cheese, and she went ahead and made meat. Everybody's happy. Although, even in a case like that, see, we're not concerned, I don't think the Gemara is concerned over here with practicalities, but maybe she would notice that he's happier than ever. And that would be something, but I doubt it. That's not the point. The point is, if these type of innocent, quote-unquote innocent lies, would help alleviate a tension in a relationship, would you advise it? And if not, if so, yes. If not, no. I mean, the reasoning behind that. It is true that you're permitted to lie for shalom bias. The only thing is that I don't know that anybody ever worked out the parameters, how far that goes. It's not, my general sense is that it's innocent, what they call white lies, where practically speaking, it doesn't really make a difference. But to deceive in matters which would make a difference, that's a different question. Generally, the kind of lies we're talking about are really minor. It's also, and that's not the only situation in terms of chesed. You know, you could say the bride is beautiful, even if you don't think so. Because what loss is involved? No one gets, see, we're talking about lies where nobody gets hurt. And it's chesed. So in general, you don't lie for no reason. But in cases where it's not like you're robbing the other person of a truth. So if somebody asks you how the bride looks and you don't think that she's good looking, or that you don't think she looks good, So, but you say that she does. What has that person lost? The only reason the person is asking is because they want to feel good. They want to feel good by the compliment. So you gave them the compliment. This is not really a situation where we talk about objective reality and truth and so on and so forth. But it is an area of chesed. So if you were going to be blunt and truthful, you'd hurt the person's feelings and for no reason. That is, there are cases where there is, I mean, we have a number of different virtues. Torah, the Yud Gimel Midos was supposed to emulate the 13 quote unquote attributes. God is Racham, Chanon, Erech Apayim, you know, merciful, compassionate, slow to anger, Rav Chesed, great in Chesed. Vanis, truth. Actually, this issue comes up. This issue comes up in Toldos, in this week's Parsha. But I would say that everything has to be applied with Seichel. I mean, you see the Chazal, the Torah is saying that you can do that for Shalom Bayis. Then I would guess that the two things, first of all, that in those circumstances, the Torah did not regard it as unethical. And that also the Torah, well, I mean, it is. It's upholding the value of Shalom Bayis over here. That's the point that's being made. This very, I would say, supreme value of Shalom Bayis, unfortunately, is not sufficiently appreciated. And people, you know, tamper with it. That is in many cases.
Which circumstances are you talking about?
In which circumstances am I talking about? In Shalom Bayis, yes. In marriage.
Okay, the ones where it's okay to lie for Shalom Bayis.
Yeah, I'm saying by teaching us that, the Torah is acknowledging, A, that it could be useful, B, but that it's necessary. And that, I don't think, however, I agree with Libby, I made the point myself, I don't think that it means, you know, that's it, you can say whatever you want to say. But, and again, I also agree, if every 5 minutes you have to tell a different lie, then there's problems. Because, you see, you can't have a strategy that's based on a lie. You can't live your life that's based on a lie. That's an impossibility. In other words, if you're going out, not going to work every day, and you're going, you know, to the bar to watch the games or whatever, you know, but you may have some good story to cover it, that's not a strategy. That's not what they're talking about. However, there's on an occasional basis, we're going to get into deep waters over here. I don't know. I don't want to how far I want to go with this. That you may have gone to see someone, a friend of yours. I don't mean a female friend, you know, and your wife can't stand the person and all of that. And if she knew that you stopped off, but I mean, there's no legitimate reason for it. There's nothing, you're not doing anything wrong or illegitimate. It's a friend that you know, for whatever reason, something happened that caused your wife to really despise this person. And the very idea that you're speaking to this person bothers her ferociously. So that's a different story. I discussed that. Because my personal belief is that I don't think that, you know, you have a right to make a demand like that on either spouse. That you can't, you know, it's kind of like the Gemara. When the husband does have the power to, you know, it's jealousy, to warn the woman not to be secluded with a certain man. That's what leads up to the sota. That's not what we're talking about. We're not talking about where there's suspicion that the person is doing something immoral with somebody else. That's a different story. I'm talking about where the action is completely okay. It's completely innocent. It's just that for whatever reason, the other spouse can't take it. And just I forbid you to speak to that person or so on. Now, so for me, I mean, if somebody came to me with that, I don't. What right do you have to forbid me? That's not. I don't see that being within the purview of the rights of a spouse. Spouses have certain rights, but I don't think it's unlimited. So, but nevertheless, let's use the word, he's got a mishigas, or she's got a mishigas on this thing. Okay, people can have a mishigas. So then, it becomes more of a practical issue. That is, what am I going to do if I want to spend, and this is a really good friend who I like, and I want to spend some time with my friend, whether it's your girlfriend that you really like, or your guy friend, whatever. Then I would say, yeah, if you can get around it, she doesn't have to know. She doesn't have a right to prohibit you, and so better off. I wouldn't fight. If you, let's say you saw this person once or twice a month, whatever, and you said, look, I'm going to see so-and-so. Oh, so that causes a whole big thing. So what do you need that? And it's not good for the shalom bayis. It's not good for the marriage. So I would say, don't tell her. Make up a fib. You know, you go into the gym. Now, if you want to be 100% accurate, so then make up to meet the guy at the gym. I'm serious. This way you're not lying. You're not lying. There is a difference. If you say, well, I'm going to the gym. Now, the real reason you're going is to meet your friend. But you didn't tell her that. And she asked you, well, what are you doing tonight? Or you said, I'm coming home late. Oh, I'm going to the gym. So that is not a lie. It's a failure to tell the whole story. I know there's an interesting expression in Yiddish that the emes darf man nicht sagen. A ligon rather. A lie you're not allowed to tell, and the truth you don't have to tell. That's an important principle to remember. So, you know, there's a time and place for everything. In that circumstance, that's what I would advise, if it's at all possible, whatever the thing was, I just made this up about not seeing a certain person. If it's at all possible to do that activity and he or she doesn't have to know, that's what I would advise. But of course, all these things have a danger. Now, my question is, what about the case we're talking about? Because we have an actual case in the Gemara. Whether it's factually true or not, because I always wonder about cases like that. Whoever wrote the Gemara, how did he get that story? You know, where'd that story come from? I don't know. Maybe it just became known. Maybe the son. But he wouldn't. See, the thing is like this. The son, no, none of the parties would have any interest in publicizing it. It sounds like Lashon Hara to tell her, you know, because she's saying a bad thing about the mother. So what do you think about that? That's what I'm asking. I think that this connects to something in Toldos. Toldos is fascinating because it entails something that we're not accustomed to. See, the Torah is always challenging, and the Torah never conforms to our innate sense of right and wrong or our religious feelings. To the contrary, very often it presents these great people doing things we couldn't conceive of. Who could have expected something like the Akedah, as we said? Now, if you find that in Toldos as well, and that I'm not talking about, I mean, people get upset about the fact that Yaakov took advantage of Esav, seemingly, when he came home from the field on that day, and he was exhausted, and he couldn't put together a meal, and he was basically starving, and it would appear that Yaakov took advantage of him, and sort of utilized that situation to acquire the Bechorah, the rights of the firstborn. I'm not talking about that. But then, you see later on, the story of the blessings, the brachos. Actually, I mean, that's a lot of people have a tough time with that. The lying factor. Jesse sent out you sent out a chazal regarding this, correct?
Yeah, two of them.
Yeah, maybe we'll check them out. Well, I wasn't exactly sure what your point was. The point being to the effect that you thought the chazal are criticizing Yaakov?
Yeah.
For lying. All right, so then you presented with the idea that Yitzchak intended to give the brachos, the blessings, to Esav. And that's a fascinating story. And Sarah Shomas, which I translated to mean that, not that she just happened to hear, but she kept watch over the situation. That is, she was hearing, she was watching, and that's why she heard this. Because they had a fundamental disagreement. That's another fascinating thing you don't expect to find in these perfect people. You know, everything, we read these stories, and we assume everything is always perfect. They're the perfect marriage, the children, and so on and so forth. Of course, that's not the case. Sarah and Avram did not always agree. And they disagreed very, very seriously on the matter of Yishmael. And it would appear, by the way, let me ask you this question. Did, when Avram went off on the journey of the Akedah, did Sarah know about it, where they were headed? Why not? What do you mean? Why doesn't it seem so?
Well, aside from the fact that it's not specified that she knew about it, there's the, is it a Rashi that says afterwards when with Chaya Sarah that when she found out about it that she died?
That's correct. That is correct. We have to, that has to be interpreted, but there is the Rashi at the beginning of Chaya Sarah, which talks about the death of Sarah and its association to the Akedah. And I do believe, let me just make sure I got it. Can I get it exactly right? Yeah, Rashi on Lispod Lasara Vilavkosa, to eulogize Sarah and cry for her. So Rashi says, V'nismacha misas Sarah l'Akedas Yitzchak. The story of the death of Sarah is connected to the Akedah. Lefisha al yidei b'soras ha'akedah, because as a result of the b'sora, the information, the news, shenes damein b'no l'shchita, that her son had been prepared for slaughter, v'chemat shelo nishchat, and barely just wasn't slaughtered, had come that close, in other words. Parcha nishmasa mimena umesa. Her soul departed from her, and she died. That's a very poignant Rashi. So I think I would agree with Libby that it would appear from this that she did not know before. She did not know about it before. But that's an amazing kind of thing. I guess it's correct psychologically, because you think it's okay. But it, you know, like, but he wasn't killed. He's alive. Why? All right, he came close. But he's alive. That's what the message, the psora, was. So if that was the psora, why would a person die from a psora? It was a good psora. How does that work? I'm always curious about that. Anybody? Your women, your mothers, you could explain it. But I would say, since nobody's answering, I would say, you tell me if I'm right, that that's a shock. The very fact that this could happen is a shock. If you hear something like that, that your child was captured by the Taliban or ISIS, and he came that close to having his head chopped off, yeah, that would be a shock. Because that itself, the fact that such a thing, that he could be placed in such grave jeopardy, is enough to give you a tremendous shock. And would it kill you? That depends on other factors. It might. So, but let me ask. So let me ask you, who told her? Who was the purveyor of that besorah? The only ones that would know about it, it seems to me, would be the way we learned. We took up the story in great depth last year, and I think we said then that the only ones that would know about it would be Avraham and Yitzchak. Just to review, what we said last year was that the purpose of the Akedah, according to the Rambam, there were two purposes. One purpose was to establish the veracity of Nevuah. Okay? That is to say that it must be real, because a person like Avraham, who's functioning on the highest possible level, and this was the most precious thing in the world to him, and yet he was prepared to do it, would not do it unless he was absolutely convinced that this is what God commanded him. And the other one was to demonstrate, because the Rambam holds that the purpose of a test is never to ascertain the level of the one who's being tested, as opposed to others who learn that that's the purpose, or the purpose is to elevate. The Ramban says that he previously, this capacity to demonstrate, to act in accordance with this degree of fear of God was in the potential. And the situation that God challenges him with brings it out into the actual. But the Rambam does not accept that. He says that the purpose of the test is for people to know, to demonstrate for the sake of mankind. One is the truth of Nevuah. The other one, to demonstrate the full extent of what the true Ato Yadati, Ki Yirei Elokim Ata. Now it shall, not that God knows, but now it shall become known. Now the world will see what a person who truly fears God is prepared to do, what the true fear of God would prompt a person to do. So the question that we asked was, but who knew about it? Who knew about it? How did it become publicized in the world? Avraham went and began to tell everybody that this is what he did. It wouldn't have any value. Either people would think he's crazy, and why would they believe him? He comes out with a story. Oh, I took my son to a mountain. God told me to slaughter him, and I was about to do it. There's no evidence that he did that. I don't think that Yitzchak went and told. Now, as far as the Na'arav, the lads that he took with them, he told them, you stay behind with the animals, and I and the lad will go and we'll pray and we'll come back. So my sense was that they wouldn't even see it. They didn't know about it. So if that's the case, how is it supposed to work? That was a question that we had. And I remember what we said. Does anybody remember what we said? We said that it'll only become known through the Torah. That when the Torah is given, of course, those who accept the Torah. So it's the word of God. So God is telling you. God is telling you this story. Just like everything else in the Torah. Why do you believe it? Because God was there, obviously. Well, that's a mild way of putting it. And God is telling you, this is what happened. That now that we know that this is what Avraham did, now the world will know that this is the way God, ultimately, it doesn't mean God's going to demand this again, but that we should strive to attain that level of fear of God, of Yiras Hashem. So if that's the case, how did Sarah become informed about it? Anyways, I saw something which I think is a little bit astounding. If that is true, if what I'm saying is true, that the whole point of the event was that it should become known, but it will only become known later on when God reveals it in the Torah. So, take a look at Chayisara. And when after, this is after the lengthy explanation that Eliezer gives to the family. And then they agree. And then they wanted to wait a few months or a year before she's ready to leave them. And he correctly, he senses that could be a problem. Now that this is the time to close the deal and bring her home with him. And then they agree. Well, they ask her. They ask her. And she says she'll go. She'll go with this man. So now in the Pasuk, this is chapter Chav Dalet, Pasuk Samach. Vayivarchu es Rivka, vayomru la. And they blessed her. And they said, Achoseinu, atayi la alfei rivava. Our sister, you shall become myriads. In other words, the implication being tremendous amount. Great, vayirash zarech eishar sonav. And your children, your descendants, will inherit the gate of their enemies. Okay, now here's what Rashi says. What does it mean, atayil alfei rivava? Take a look at the Rashi. At v'zarech tekablu osa bracha. Shenemar li'avram b'hara moria. You and your descendants will receive the blessing that was said to Avram on Har Moria. Harba arbe zaracha. God blessed Avram after he passed the test of the Akedah. I shall greatly multiply your children. So they said, Yehi ratzon shehei oso hazera mimeich. May it be as well that zera, that offspring that Hashem was talking about, should be from you. V'loma isha acheres, and not from another woman. So what are they saying? They knew about the Akedah then. Not only they knew about the Akedah, then they knew about the bracha that God had given Abraham. How is that possible? Let's bear in mind, the Rambam says that, it seems anyways, that the Nevuah of Abraham, that Hashem gave to Abraham, was not meant for the sake of people. He didn't use those prophecies to influence people. It's only Moshe was the first prophet that was sent by God with a specific prophecy to the people, to Paro, and then to the Jews as well. But he says that Avram taught by virtue of reason and ideas. He never said that God told me to tell you that you should do such and such. So therefore I wonder, how would anybody have known of the prophecies? Now,
but there have been a purpose in Avram. Oh, sorry.
Let me just finish my
the
point.
I was going to ask if there were the...
Just give me a second.
Sure.
No, just give me a second. Because I'm not saying that nobody knew. I would say that all the nevuos that he had, it wasn't that when he died, that was it. Nobody knew about him. I'm sure he passed it down to Yitzchak. That became part of the body of Torah, the Torah teachings that the family shared. And then to Yaakov, that is, if you ask, did Yaakov know about the Akedah? I would say yes. I can't see why, because there was tremendous Torah involved, teaching. Yitzchak didn't have to be told, he was there. And although, because we raised the question that, that the Torah is omitting such a vital part of the story that from our standpoint, what did Yitzchak say to Avraham? After he untied him, when he got the message from the Malach, and what was their discussion on the way home? The Torah doesn't share that, but I mean, I would guess that they shared the ideas that Avraham told them the Nevuah and the whole philosophy behind the Akedah and so on and so forth, and then that became part of their body of knowledge. And then Yitzchak passed it on to Yaakov, and Yaakov to the Shvatim, the 12 sons. So it did become part of the body of a Jewish knowledge. Okay. How that would find its way to Lavan, that's a hard one. That's a hard one. I mean, it's a good question whether Eliezer was told. Eliezer was a student. Was this shared with Eliezer? And perhaps, I don't know, I haven't gone through all the Midrashim over there. I don't know that, doesn't seem from the plain telling of the story that Lavan and the family knew that much about Avram. Because he tells him over, who, my master, and that God gave him everything, and he had a son. He told him the basics. So anyways, I just found this, I found this Rashi to be very, very strange, that not only would they know about the Akedah, not only would they know about the Akedah, but they would also know about the Bracha. And they would reference that in the Bracha that they gave to Rivka. Because, for example, we took up the fact that he circumcised all the males. And that was the sign of the oath of the bris. So it makes sense to say that he shared this knowledge with them. I mean, he didn't just coerce them to have a circumcision without any idea behind it. So therefore, it could be that you're right. That is the question being, that whole group that he was the leader of, he had a movement. That whole group of people that were part of his entourage and his camp and so on, what exactly did he share with them? It may be that he did share. That doesn't rule it out. The fact is, the Rambam says, the tool of his teaching was not the Nevuah. He didn't approach them with that. The tool of his teaching was reason and logic, ideas. Yeah, but that doesn't rule out that he taught them about the phenomenon of Nevuah and that he could have shared his prophecies with them. For example, when we discussed that last week, you know, in terms of extolling the great qualities of Avram, that he could get these people, all of these people, and they weren't children, some of them older, some of them younger, to go along with circumcision. That's quite an achievement. I mean, we're talking about adults, to submit to that. Now, let's ask ourselves the question, when he spoke to them, did he try to use reason to convince them to have a bris, or did he say it's from God? It seems to me that he's going to approach them and present it as an idea that he's had. I would imagine many, especially the methods that Avraham used, the reason and logic, I'm sure that he encouraged all of the people to question. Ask questions. As the Rambam says, after he discovered the true God, he engaged in debates. And by reason, he was able to show them the falsity of their ideas. So I'm sure that when he taught, he encouraged people to ask him. So if he merely presented the idea of bris, mila, as an idea of his own, I can't imagine why anybody would go along with it. What's the logic of that? And it's endangering. There's danger involved in it. So why do it? Thus, he had to tell them that he received it as a prophecy from God. So it could be you're right that he did share the Nevuos that he had with those who, that is, who are you going to share it with? You're only going to share it with someone who's convinced of your ideas and your legitimacy. And then, you know, that there's such a thing as Nevuah. And then you could share with them that you've had Nevuah. So I sort of changing my position on that. I don't think we have to, you know, take that position that nobody knew. that nobody knew. Okay. Now, which ones, whether he would share, the thing is like this, though, that you do have to be careful, because you have to decide whether the Akedah is kind of explosive. I don't know, you share that with anyone. Person's got to be on a level where he can appreciate the idea. Otherwise, it'll just harm him. It's just that it's a little bit strange that Lavan would have known the particular bracha that was given at Har Moria. Whether Eliezer communicated that, or whether you don't have to take it literally. Maybe you don't have to take it literally. It's just an expression of the fact that they do recognize that this family is destined to become a great nation. And they're giving her the bracha that she should be the one, that it should come from her. Okay, I just thought though that it was interesting. Now, do we know who decided to communicate this to Sarah? I don't know if we know, but I don't know really if that's so important. That's not the point of curiosity over here. But the point of it is that we understand why she wasn't told. That is, if she couldn't deal with the information according to this, that is, we can understand that. She wasn't a youngster at the time, but you can imagine the type of relationship that she had with Yitzchak. I'm sure you can all imagine that. I mean, Avraham was able to overcome the emotions. And most people find it difficult, you know, how could Avraham? But still, he's the father, and to a certain extent, I guess, could detach himself. But could, let's say, this command was given to Sarah, or let's say Sarah knew about it, could she have been able to do it? Well, if you find that even after, post-facto, after the event, and in the court, he's okay, he's alive. But merely by telling her how close he came to death, that had a shocking effect on her. So it doesn't seem like she would have been able to deal with that news. That's why I don't think the Torah doesn't mention it, but that the fact that the Torah doesn't mention it doesn't prove it. But it's something then that Avraham withheld. We're talking about withholding information. So that makes perfect sense. That truth was something that she didn't need to know. That would have been... I'm not denying that she was a great... You know, in terms of she was a prophet and she was a great woman. And if that's the will of Hashem, that's the will of Hashem. I'm not saying that she would have refused. But the point is, there is a difference between acknowledging something intellectually and emotion, the emotional impact. That, you know, a person says, Baruch Dayan Emes. So they're not blaming God for something. They're accepting the divine decree. But it could be crushing. On the emotional level, it should be crushing. You can't deal with it. They can't survive it. So that's what I would say. Although, I mean, it's a little bit of a strange chazal because, again, whoever came, the psora. That's a separate point. What would be the motivation to want to tell Sarah?
Something has to be somebody, though.
It could be somebody, but I don't know if we can identify. I don't think that's important, but when it says the Satan, it's not referring to, like, Satan flying through the air. The Satan means it stemmed from a certain emotion, a certain, would seem an aggressive emotion. It wasn't... See, I would say that, let's say it was a person. Let's say it was a person that knew about it. Okay, let's say, I don't know, Eliezer or whatever it was. Somebody found out about it. And told Sarah. Why did they have to tell Sarah? Now, what would you do if you knew about it? If you were in that situation, would you tell? I would say that there are certain very, very powerful emotions at work. And telling, being the bearer of a psora, that's a big thing. Everybody wants to be the bearer of the psora, because that puts you, I mean, if there's any kind of news, something big, you want to get it before it's on the news, because you know about it. That gives you a certain importance. It makes you feel powerful. So there is an emotion of wanting to tell. Wow, this is an amazing thing. You're not going to believe what happened with Avraham and Yitzchak. Now you're going to say, yeah, but, you know, it's not the most pleasant thing in the world. It's not the most pleasant thing in the world. So, but you're going to say to yourself, yeah, but everything's fine. In other words, you want to gratify your own emotion. That's what I would say is the satan. Many things we do, and we could justify them. Of course, I'm going to tell them. It's great news. It's great news. Your son, he was in this terrible automobile crash, and 4 people died instantaneously, and he just walked away with a scratch. Oh, it's great, great news. Yeah, but this could destroy a person. But your need to be the one who knows, and your need to be the one who tells, so that's the satan. Because you got to be very careful. It's very complicated, and you got to put yourself in the mind of the person receiving that news, and what you think is such a exciting piece of information can be devastating. You got to be very, very careful. That's right. It's not your business to tell, especially something so delicate as that. So, and there would be a case where maybe you lie. You say, I don't know. If someone asks you, because you got to weigh the consequences. It could be extremely, extremely damaging. That's what it's telling you. This piece of information, see, it would appear it wasn't Avraham that told her. It wasn't Yitzchak that told her. Somehow or other, the information got to her. I mean, according to this. Again, I don't know that that's the literal. That otherwise she would have lived and this killed her. That's taking it too literally. I think they mean to say that for an older woman and so on and so forth, and she had a child, she didn't have a child, you know, she was over that, but that could have weakened her too. That it contributed. I think they're meaning to say that something like this can kill you. It can definitely contribute to death.